This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, it's Christmas time again. Decorations are all hung by the fire. Everybody's singing, all the bells are ringing out, and it's Christmas. Oh,
Place to Be Nation. How are you? Happy holidays to you. This is Todd Weber. You've joined me for the latest episode of Conversation Comics. This is the busiest time of year for me, and probably for you. Lots of stuff going on, getting those last-minute presents for your loved ones. I've got lots of rehearsals going on every night for my upcoming Christmas Eve worship service at my church. Buying lots of presents for my kids, for my wife. Still working until Thursday. Thursday will be my last day at work for about 10 days, and then I'll have a nice break until January 4th. So, lots of time to catch up on comics reading for me, catching up on DC shows on the CW, catching up on movies I may have missed, but up until Christmas, I'm pretty jam-packed, but had some time to record with Mr. Tim Capel. We're looking at the Uncanny X-Men run from the late 70s, written by Chris Claremont, drawn by John Byrne. Such great comics. Hope you enjoy this talk that Tim and I do regarding the Uncanny X-Men. So, without further ado, let's bring him on, my special guest. He is the co-host of Survey Says, a WCW retrospective on the main Place to Be Nation podcast feed. And we're glad to have him here on the Pop Feed talking comics with you. So, once again, here's Mr. Tim Capel.
Tim, how's it going?
It is going great, Todd, and the listeners need not know that this is actually a separate conversation.
They have.
For all intents and purposes, we could just be continuing right on from part one, right?
Yes, it's Thanksgiving weekend here.
Yes.
And it's the longest recording session ever. Oh, no, that's not true. But
and the longest Thanksgiving ever.
Yeah. Well, this was a pretty long one with all the political discussion and debate that was going on at my Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah, I feel you there.
Get me out of here. So we are reviewing, or we are re-reviewing, going back through memory lane, looking at the Byrne Claremont run of X-Men from the late 70s to the early 80s. And last we had left our fearless X-Men, most of the team was in Japan. After their Savage Land adventures, they had been they hitched a ride on a Japanese freighter, and they ended up being attacked by a group of mandroids. Yes, mandroids in Japan. And at the end of the last issue, a mandroid revealed that Moses Magnum, who was behind all the attacks. Now, who is Moses Magnum? Had he appeared in things before?
Right. So Moses Magnum is kind of I don't even want to say a third string or D-list villain. I'm not even sure he ranks that highly. He had first appeared, I want to say, in a Spider-Man annual. And literally his deal is he has earthquake powers. He can, I guess, generate vibratory shockwaves sufficient to create earthquakes. So sounds like a pretty big deal. And he acquired those powers by literally falling into an earthquake. Oh. As the ground was opening, he falls into it and somehow is imbued with powers. That actually gets retconned, which we can talk about towards the conclusion of this little storyline, in a way that makes a little bit more sense, but is still quite odd. He had also somewhat recently before this turned up in a Power Man story written by Chris Claremont. So this is just Claremont porting over one of the characters he had used in a non-X-Men capacity, which we know he was rather fond of.
Yeah, you see that a bit with the Power Man Iron Fist supporting cast, and sometimes Luke Cage and Danny Rand themselves would show up in X-Men and vice versa. So,
This storyline also has Misty Knight and Colleen Wing on loan from Power Man and Iron Fist.
Yeah, so Moses Magnum, he's kind of a mort, kind of a tool of a villain. What are his motivations here? Is he an eco-terrorist, as they say, or?
It's rather unclear. He demands vaguely that he wants to be the ruler, or I guess the new emperor of Japan. And if the government does not accede to his demands, he's going to sink the island, which not quite sure how that works, how you sink an island, but perhaps he's going to use his powers to shake it to bits. And I don't know if they had called his bluff, then what leverage does he really have? Is he going to go through with it? It seems a rather ill thought out plan on his part. And interestingly enough, it occurs to me in looking over the storyline, the X-Men actually spent 6 weeks on this Japanese freighter, and it is stated that Cyclops really put the team through the paces, keeping them in shape. They don't have the advantage of the danger room here, so I can't imagine what kind of beating that Japanese freighter took while the X-Men were on board. And somehow it never managed to come up that Wolverine was fluent in Japanese while they're on this ship. But that is established in the course of this story as well.
Yeah, you never
asked,
right?
So we get a little bit of that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I didn't know you could do that. And meanwhile, they're met in Japan by former X-Man Sunfire.
Mm-hmm.
And is that – what's his first – is it Shiro?
Shiro Yoshida.
Yoshida, yeah. And
Yoshido.
I remember him from Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. He actually had a solo episode or a guest starring episode where he fell in love with Firestar,
yeah.
Yeah, Angelica Jones. And then you find out that they were both X-Men, and really when you go back and look, he was the first one who quit the team after Thunderbird died in 94, or was it X-Men 94?
In issue 95, that's when Thunderbird died, and Sunfire actually quit right before that mission. I guess it would have been in 94 because Sunfire barely qualifies as a former X-Man, just kind of an all-around arrogant jerk, which is part of his charm. So this first time we see him since that story. And if you're in Japan, it's sort of obligatory that you have to include Sunfire, the resident Japanese superhero.
Yeah, he was pretty much it before Big Hero 6, which is
right.
You see these days, the Scott Lobdell created Big Hero 6, I believe.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, and so Magnum's about to unleash his biggest earthquake, or he's got this. I don't know. It looks like a mountain or a plateau, not totally different than Mount Fuji or something, but he's setting it up, and Banshee blocks it with his sonic scream. Not sonic scream, that's Black Canary. What's Banshee's scream called?
Just all around sonic powers. I guess you could call it a sonic scream. Yeah. It's not dissimilar from Black Canary. He just He's a little bit more versatile in what he can do with his powers. Regrettably, though, this is the last time we see him use his powers for a while.
Yeah. Overexerts his voice, and he's done for a long time, which turns into a plot device, too.
It does, and he is indisposed for quite a long period of time, actually. He doesn't regain his powers until it's 100 issues plus from here. It's like the late 80s, I want to say, when he actively is using his powers again. So this doesn't take him off the board just yet. But as far as being able to contribute to the superhero fight scenes that we know and love from this run, he becomes kind of an afterthought, unfortunately. Something else I noticed about, I guess it's issue 119.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Christmas themed,
yes.
Well, not Christmas themed issue, but it takes place around Christmas time. And I'm always a sucker for the holiday stories. So, we learned that once Banshee is released from the hospital, that he thinks, the team has ditched him, which is kind of a douchey move, but it's actually they're throwing a surprise party for him when he gets back to the Clan Yashida estate. They have prepared quite a spread for Sean Cassidy, and it says Merry Christmas. And so we kind of catch up and touch base with where everyone's at and the overall passage of time here as this world tour arc marches forward.
Yeah, and let's see, we have Colossus being homesick a little bit because,
mm-hmm.
you know, he contrasts himself with the rest of the X-Men where he says he actually has a family, and though we haven't seen Ileana for a long time, she was very, very young, back in Giant Size, I think, is the first, last time we see it. Maybe he's a little nostalgic for all the traditional Russian Christmases that he's had in his youth.
Yes, and this is where we start to see him kind of questioning his role on the team. He has a few blunders in the battle, like the issue before with the Mandroids. I think he kind of gets taken out of the fight pretty early and in somewhat humiliating fashion, and that continues here. So he's on kind of a losing streak as far as being much of an impact player as part of this new team of X-Men. So that's going to play out over the next few issues as well. There was sort of a, I don't know, almost, I wouldn't even call it a hinting of a love triangle between Colossus, Storm, and Nightcrawler. When this run started up, it seemed like Colossus was sort of putting the moves on Storm. She was reciprocating a little bit, and then Nightcrawler was getting flirtatious with her too. This kind of goes back to the Cockrum stuff. But here, that's all basically laid to rest as Storm acknowledges that she thinks of the X-Men as a family more so than anything. And she refers to Colossus as little brother for the first time. And that's one of those Claremont nicknames that you'll see come around quite a bit. And that's one I've always had some fondness of, just their friendship and their relationship in general. And it's sort of a shame that's fallen by the wayside over the years.
I just think there's been so many characters added to the mythos since then. You lose track of just the core relationships between these original X-Men, new X-Men. And, yeah, it was a nice moment with them as a family and the end of this threat. But we go across the globe to Muir Island, and we find Jean Grey is there visiting Moira MacTaggert and some future X-Factor members, we'll find out.
Yeah, it's funny how we've got, half of the future X-Factor team here, and Havoc, Polaris, and Jamie Madrox, who are all, for various reasons, hanging out on Muir Island. I guess Jamie was Moira's assistant in the lab at the time. He had only had a handful of appearances before this. I want to say he debuted in like a Fantastic Four annual or Giant Size or something. So a very minor character at this point, but they're all hanging out in Scotland. And yeah, we catch up with Jean there, who you'll recall from our conversation part one that Jean is of the belief that the rest of the X-Men are dead, and they think likewise of her because they were separated after their big ass fight with Magneto and sort of went their separate ways. Beast as well thinks the rest of the team are dead because he was part of the group that was separated, and it was just him and Jean there for a little bit.
And so Professor X is in space too.
Professor X is in space, banging Lilandra, right?
Yeah. The two-dimensional haired Lilandra, triangle hand.
And rather two-dimensionally characterized.
Yeah, always. and still to this day, I think.
Yeah, I shouldn't say at this point. She never gets much more shading, does she?
Yeah. So on Muir Island, we have our little cliffhanger. Gene's there with the little team that Moira's got. And we have a security guard walking around, and he stumbles across Mutant X all locked up. And so, actually, is he a security guard? He might be a saboteur or something.
Yeah, I think that guy, it's a weird callback here. So back during the Phoenix saga, there was that was a pretty episodic storytelling device because the book was bi-monthly at the time. And so there was one segment of that story that took place on Muir Island, and the X-Men rented a hovercraft from this dude, which Magneto destroyed, and he's pissed about that. So literally, this is his motivation, as you said, like a he's a saboteur here. He wants to get to the bottom of what happened to his hovercraft, because I'm sure it's affecting his business. So in some vague, undisclosed way, he's going to now exact his revenge on Moira MacTaggert and, I guess, the X-Men by extension. But that goes rather badly for him. We'll continue to see him sort of skulking, you know, here and there throughout the next few issues before what this whole Mutant X plot line really represents actually heats up.
Yeah, pretty random, actually. Right. I mean, that's the definition of random. We have a Scottish hovercraft renter.
His name is Angus McWhirter.
Yeah. And I can't do a great Scottish accent, but you know.
Neither can I. That's about the extent.
I'm not
going
to try. Let's recruit Greg Phillips to do that. So
we need to.
X-Men, next issue, that they leave Japan and they are headed back to New York. Yes.
Well, they're on their way. Yes, but they're going to get sidetracked because they are attacked. They're in a plane, which this is not a hovercraft or other vehicle that gets destroyed by Magneto, but evidently this plane was on loan from Jaron Hogarth. He's a lawyer, and Misty Knight and Colleen Wing work for him. So another Power Man, Iron Fist supporting character. If the name sounds familiar, you might recall this character was reconceptualized for the Jessica Jones Netflix TV series. The character played by Carrie Ann Moss, yep. Jerry Hogarth. Well, he's a dude in the comics, but pretty much same character. So anyway, yeah, they're on their way back to New York, but are intercepted by who we will later learn are Alpha Flight and forced to land. I think it's in Calgary, isn't it?
Calgary, Alberta, Canada, home of the Hart family dungeon.
Right.
Wouldn't that be great if that was why they crashed? Stu Hart here. I'll get you, X-Men. Take you down to the dungeon.
Right.
Stretch out.
Keep the obscure references coming, right?
Yeah. No, we have quite a crossover between wrestling and comic book fans here. So,
Yes.
I hear Calgary, especially if I hear the Calgary Stampede, I think of.
Oh, yes.
1997's pay-per-view, August pay-per-view. Or no, July pay-per-view. There it is. Anyway, they're
both. Well, wasn't that the title of one of these two issues?
Part two is the – it's not – it's called – In Your House, Canadian Stampede, or something
right.
like that.
No, it's called like Stampede in Calgary or something like that.
And that's actually their annual rodeo, right, is the Calgary Stampede?
I think so,
I think that is. And so it was timed out with that. Cool. So
something like that.
Before they left Japan, though, on Hogarth, the hoary host of no, that's something else.
Right.
That's Doctor Strange.
We're really getting our references crossed now.
Wolverine is able to say goodbye to Mariko. Ishida, his crush, whose inner monologue reveals that she's thinking of him, too, which is pretty cool.
And he's got it bad for her.
Yeah, he does. He's got a nice... You see an actual Wolverine smile. A genuine...
I was going to point out the same thing, yeah.
How often do you see that character smile at this point in time? You don't. And it's nice. It's pleasant.
It's just so unusual that you would think just a single panel of a character smiling shouldn't really register. But because it is just so different for Wolverine, I don't know that we've ever seen him smile up to this point. It really does stand out. Of course, we also see, I don't know if this is the first appearance of it, but that iconic look for him in his civilian garb of the flannel shirt, leather jacket, and his cowboy hat.
Yeah, I don't think we get that till she's in New York.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
He's still in costume when he says goodbye to her. And, we'll see what he's on in the airplane. In the airplane, he is wearing his flannel. So,
all right.
Okay. So, but not when he says goodbye to Mariko.
Yeah, that one was distinctly costumed. He's grinning ear to ear in his mask, which, it's a nice little scene. So, evidently, Alpha Flight was dispatched to reclaim Wolverine by Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau.
Pierre Trudeau, and he was drawn somewhat cartoonishly by John Byrne here.
He sure was.
Yeah, I don't know that it's very flattering or if he's just trying to do a likeness, but it's kind of...
I mean, Byrne is Canadian, so, I mean, I don't know what his personal feelings towards Pierre Trudeau may have been at the time, but yeah, he is a little bit off kilter there.
Yeah, he seems like a random, I don't know, just like a villain of the month or something, or a Roxxon executive, but he's he's wearing an ascot and he's got his hair back in, almost looks like a I don't know how you describe it. It's swept back.
It's rather foppish, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. But you see him and he's talking to James Hudson, telling him, "I won't, you've got this one chance to get him back, and then, reclaim our property." And
they consider Wolverine or Weapon X as their property, and he went AWOL to join the X-Men. So that's a major problem. We saw James McDonald Hudson here as. He's now known as Vindicator, right?
Yes.
But when we first met him, he was Weapon Alpha.
Alpha, right.
And that was...
When was that, 116?
109,
okay.
I want to say.
Earlier than that. Okay. And
it was early in Byrne's run.
We haven't seen Heather Hudson just yet.
No, we have not seen her. She is mentioned by... Vindicator at one point, but we don't really know who she is. It's in the next issue that Wolverine is fighting with Vindicator, and Hudson is taking this very personally because he reminds Wolverine that it was he and his wife Heather who sort of nursed Logan back to health and helped him regain his humanity. We don't know at the time exactly what they're referencing here because none of the Weapon X stuff had been even hinted at. But evidently they helped Wolverine at a very low moment. And he is basically telling him, you were a feral beast when we found you and that you have any sort of life now, you kind of owe to us. Which, interesting spin on that, I guess. But for the most part, this is one of those conflicts that the X-Men are basically dragged into that they don't want any part of. Like, you can, and it's funny the way that these, the tone of these two issues is kind of like, they are so over it. They just want to get home. They do not want to mix it up with Alpha Flight, but Alpha Flight are just being such dicks about this whole thing. And Cyclops in particular is pissed when he, towards the end of this little two-parter, he is just so done with these assholes. He blasts Northstar in the face, knocks him out, and they come to an agreement essentially where Alpha Flight is going to hand over, I think it's Nightcrawler, who they had kind of taken prisoner,
yeah,
if they can have Wolverine back. And Cyclops is like, fuck that. And it's actually Wolverine in a little bit of a role reversal who has to talk Cyclops down.
He's like, yeah.
He's like, no, I'll go with them. I don't want to, you know, be the cause of any further consternation here. And I mean, Cyclops and the rest of the team, they are just not having it. And I guess they do agree to the deal. They leave out of Canada. And you can tell they must have just been stewing the whole time, because it's like the next panel, Cyclops is like, turn the plane around. Fuck this.
Right.
And then what's the great reveal here at the end?
Well, is that Wolverine had already broken out, you know?
Yes.
And he just shows up in the cockpit like, I was already here. They ain't built a cage that can hold me, bub. But that whole little adventure in Calgary is kind of fun. You have Banshee and Storm at the mall or at a boutique shopping for clothes with Colleen and Misty. And well, not Colleen, but they dress up Storm in some contemporary clothes, and Banshee talks about how that's not exactly what I'm used to seeing Storm in. You know, she's supposed to be kind of almost half naked, I suppose. Storm just isn't right. And then
he's definitely used to it, and Storm is pretty comfortable being seen that way.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a nice little bit of characterization for them. And he tries to use his powers at one point when they are, I think it's Vindicator who intercepts them at the mall. He tries to use his power and it's just stricken with pain. And that's when he sort of realizes he might be out of the game.
Yeah. He's just kind of dead weight on the team there. And, you know, the team's hanging out in Calgary while they're waiting for the plane to be repaired, waiting for the storm to pass.
Mm-hmm.
And
this storm was actually created by
Shaman. I think. Right. Shaman.
Uh-huh.
And
Alpha Flight.
Right. We learn Alpha Flight's behind this, but they're slowly revealed over the course of the two issues. What did you think of Alpha Flight, Tim?
At the time of reading these issues, I was already familiar with the team. I think we talked about in our first part that I had first read this entire run in the Essentials volumes. So, I mean, I knew who Alpha Flight was. I think probably my first proper introduction to them would have been the X-Men animated series. They got a spotlight episode, which pretty much borrowed the plot of this story, where they're just trying to reclaim Wolverine. The rest of the team doesn't really appear and doesn't interact with Alpha Flight. It's really just Wolverine defending himself from their various attacks. But that was probably my intro to them. And I don't know. I guess it's one of those things where thinking about it intellectually, you're like, it makes sense that the Canadian government would have a publicly sponsored superhero team, the way that the Avengers sort of exist in that vein for the United States. And the Canadian government of the Marvel Universe is rather surprisingly militaristic and advanced in their technology and rather shady dealings. So, I mean, in context, it makes sense. They've never been a favorite of mine or anything. And this issue, this introduction, didn't do a whole lot to change that. But, I mean, even John Byrne talks about how he created Alpha Flight even before his days as a pro. They were just sort of fan creations that he was playing around with. And finally, he now had the proper forum to introduce these characters. And he says he didn't really flesh out any of them beyond, I guess, Vindicator. And he took issue with that name as well. He didn't like Claremont rechristening James McDonald Hudson as Vindicator, because in his words, what does Canada have to vindicate itself of?
I shall avenge.
What?
Who has wronged us here?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome.
But, in any case, he says he just brought them in to be antagonists, another team for the X-Men to fight, who weren't necessarily supervillains. So I think they're effective in that role. I know he does a lot of good work with them later in their solo series, which I've read some of. But that's kind of a neat little underrated book, at least those first.
The
first probably
24. Yeah, the first 24 episodes, issues, when it was all Byrne, and then before they did the weird creative team switch with the Hulk.
Yes, who was it? Bill Mantlow?
Mantlow and Mike Mignola.
Mm-hmm. And they did some very bizarre, very bizarre stories.
It was strange, and James Hudson had just died at the end of that arc. Actually, he died at the end of 12, and then had Box, and it was a crazy team. This initial look at Alpha Flight, we don't have Puck, who is probably my favorite Alpha Flight character, because he's a true dwarf. You know, he's an actual dwarf with super agility. Not even super agility, just very agile. I don't think he has any powers necessarily. And it turns
I'm not sure that he does. Mantlow did later retcon that his dwarfism was a
curse or something.
A magical curse.
Yeah.
And once it was lifted, he became a full statured individual for a brief time. It was strange. It was just, I guess the word problematic comes to mind.
I think that's I would be offended were I a little person and our only real superhero was revealed to be.
I mean, right? Where, this is a curse. He's not supposed to be this way. This is all wrong. I mean, it just seems, that's kind of fucked up.
Yeah. Yeah. And we had Myrna too, who was more of a mutant type character, almost Atlantean. She was they didn't do a whole lot of useful things with her.
No, she went on to marry Namor.
Namor for a while,
transformed into like a Leviathan sea monster who he had to kill. So that was a little different.
Yeah. And these two issues, there's no other mention about Jean being in Scotland with, I guess we call it Muir Island. And it's just
right. Yeah, I was never entirely clear exactly. I mean, they talk about being in Scotland, but I always think Scotland in the context of X-Men just meaning Muir Island.
Right.
So I know that eventually we'll be talking about Muir Island proper, but for all intents and purposes, I mean, I'm assuming that's where we are since we've got more as research base. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to struggle to say her first name every time it comes up, by the way.
Yes.
So I'm gonna.
Was it the kind of thing that you would read it and have your own pronunciation, and then when?
Sort of. I guess. I think my vocal cords just don't want to form those words, that word. So it's like Moira.
Yeah.
Just comes out strangely.
I think I made it into a three syllable word as a kid. It was Moira.
Moira.
Moira MacTaggart.
Well, I really struggled with Wolfsbane, her
Rain?
Real name of Rain Sinclair. I always thought it was Renee for some reason.
Ronnie.
So,
Ray. Yeah.
Rain. So, but in any case, it seems like this period of Marvel in general, we talked about somewhat mercurial editorial tendencies of one Jim Shooter, right? He had kind of an edict, as legend goes, that you didn't do more than two-part stories at this point. He really liked one-and-done stories and did not like for things to drag on more than two issues. And while this is an extended arc of the X-Men fighting Magneto and then winding up in the Savage Land, going on to Japan, going on to Canada, they're told in these little two-issue bursts, it seems like. And I feel like that was probably a Shooterism. I don't know that you necessarily want to devote more issues to the X-Men in Japan or the X-Men in Canada, but just structurally, it seems like it is coming about through that editorial hand. Yeah. But I don't know. That may be me reading between the lines.
It does seem like everything's in two-issue bursts, two-issue beats, and they're short
until
stories.
Later. That changes a little bit later, but for now, and I believe that's probably just Claremont and Byrne getting more latitude as storytellers and as the book was picking up steam. I think it was Roger Stern who was directly editing the book at this time.
Right now, yeah.
But later on, we would, of course, get Louise Simonson, then Louise Jones, who talks about how Claremont needed very, very little editorial oversight. She was pretty content to leave him to his own devices, and Shooter didn't seem to have much of a problem with that until he did. And yeah. We'll get there.
So 121 wraps up. They're all together in the airplane, and we have this happy ending. We don't have a cliffhanger. We have just, we're going home. Hey, all right. We have like the equivalent of a wrestling pay-per-view. Oh, I did it again. Where all the storylines have been finished, and you know, you just have actual resolution and
you do, which, and I mean, the reason to even draw a lot of attention to it is because that was a rarity for X-Men stories. They're kind of, they've established this trend of doing like Pyrrhic victories where they do get a win, but it's not quite a clean one, to use another wrestling analogy. Like, they beat Magneto, but the volcano erupts and seemingly kills half the team. Same deal in the Savage Land, where they beat the bad guy, who was at Garrock, but like at the cost of his life. In Japan, they save the island, defeat Moses Magnum, but Banshee has now lost his powers. So here they do get kind of a straight up win. You're right, we don't get a lot in the way of subplotting in these two issues. We do see sort of some development of Scott and Colleen's friendship relationship turning into maybe something a little bit more.
Yeah. This next kind of like New York bit. Yes.
Yeah. They're like canoodling on the plane a little bit here. And somebody like Nightcrawler or someone takes note of the fact that they have been pretty much inseparable for the leg of their journey. So something's going on with them.
Hmm. Which will, Scott Summers doesn't become, I don't know, he puts off his grieving, perhaps.
It's sort of, it's wonky the way that they handle this. So he thinks Jean is dead, and they kind of hand wave it by saying she has changed so much since she leveled up, as we described in the first part, with these, you know, Phoenix abilities, that she is sort of become like a different person to him, and losing her, he's not quite sure how to process it because he wasn't sure where their relationship was at in the first place. And maybe some of that is just him trying to wall himself off from the grief he's experiencing, because that's what Cyclops does. And, you know, just trying to keep moving, keep the team together, get back home. So he's not letting him feel these things. But at the same time, he is sort of entertaining the idea of a relationship with somebody else. So it's like it does leave his grief, or lack thereof, of his relationship with Jean / Phoenix in a weird, nebulous place. Which they kind of drew attention to, actually, in the letter columns in these issues. I mean, there were people writing in kind of saying, what's going on with Scott and Jean? We know each thinks the other is dead, but even though that's not really the case, shouldn't that be reflected a little bit more in the stories? And it's just not. And that's part of this whole the X-Men are dead running gag that becomes a little bit hard to swallow. I mean, you had Misty Knight never mentioning that she just saw Jean in New York back when they were in Japan. Cyclops, no one else says to her or suggests, hey, Jean is dead. We know you guys were roommates and friends, and let's commiserate. I mean, it just never comes up. And that's
kind of weird. Yeah, that's you know how Roger said, well, Chris Claremont didn't really need an editor at the time. Well,
he could have used one there.
He was kind of phoning in his editorial duties, because
there's stuff that at the end of the day, we're talking about superhero comics where people are turning into organic steel and teleporting and shooting laser blasts out of their eyes. But that kind of thing I can deal with, because at least it's internally consistent. But when it comes to plot holes that you can drive a truck through, that's where my tolerance starts to wane a bit. And this, I mean, increasingly the wheels start to fall off of this thing as it goes on. I mean, I think it was also mentioned that an attempt was made to phone the mansion while they were in Japan, and like the phone lines had been disconnected, even the direct line to Cerebro. Why would anyone ever call him to Cerebro, by the way?
Yeah.
Can you imagine Professor X is sitting there with the big helmet on looking for mutants, and it's like he gets a collect call from Moira and Muir Island or something. I mean, how does that work exactly? Does he get disconnected from Cerebro? If the call comes in?
I'm just imagining that happening. There are these random things thrown in there that, okay, I guess, you know.
Right.
Okay. I even tried to call the direct line to Cerebro.
It's like he knows he has to pay lip service to these things, but Claremont is still not doing a very good job of covering for himself.
Maybe on some level, this is going back to Scott and Jean, maybe on some level Scott knew that it would be retconned years later that wasn't really Jean. That was the Phoenix Force pretending to be Jean. Jean's in a cocoon at the bottom of the ocean.
Oh, yes. Yes. So that's why he feels nothing for this person who isn't actually
Jean. So he said goodbye in X-Men 100 or X 101 or whatever, which was years ago at this point.
Yeah, I don't exactly. Know.
Funny. So we get back and we have the iconic Danger Room sequence where they're back at the mansion and there's no Professor X, so Cyclops is in charge of everything. So they're all working.
He's got to get the lights back on. Evidently, the power company has just shut them down and they're just running on shoestring budget here.
Do they mention that, or are you making that up?
No, they actually do mention that. Wow. And
wouldn't Professor X had made arrangements, you know?
They say, they actually say that, and this is more Scott and Colleen stuff, he mentions to her that Moira is the executor of Xavier's estate. And so he's been trying to get in touch with her And I don't know that everyone is just really bad at using the phone or it's just a case of bad timing, but no one seems to be able to get in touch with anyone. This is one of those problems that would be solved by the modern world,
yes,
cell phones and everything
you
else.
You would not have this issue.
Because it's just no one can get in touch with any. And, I mean, they talk about how weeks have passed since they got home. So, I mean, this has been going on for a while. And has Banshee tried to get in touch with Moira? Is she supposed to be, like, the love of his life? And I don't know. It just seems, again, reading it and on a monthly basis, you're probably not registering or keeping a scorecard of these kind of things, but they do tend to tally up when you read them all in a short burst like this.
Yeah, apparently Scott has to go down to the phone company and restore communications to the X-Mansion.
Yeah, exactly.
At this point. you do have the sequence with Banshee and Nightcrawler working on the X-Jet, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
They've got their coveralls, and it's funny because you see Nightcrawler in this really goddish green coveralls with the red cap and yellow gloves, which looks fine on Banshee because those are his actual colors.
Right.
But, yeah.
But of course, Nightcrawler is himself blue, so it's a bit of a clash of color palettes.
Yeah, just really little things that bug me. Oh, and the intercom works fine at the X-Mansion, so there's apparently they've got a hard wire or something. You know, it's not a matter of the phone being down where they can,
right,
at least they can talk to room to room.
Yeah, so certain logistics they seem to have a better handle on than others, I guess. And Colossus is referred to by his full name of, oh gosh, Pyotr Nikolaevich Rasputin.
Yep.
And I don't know that we've seen that up to this point, because we get his, you know, his kind of anglicized name of just Peter Rasputin, mm-hmm, which, I mean, that's how I've always thought of him, but that he is Russian, or I suppose at this point Soviet, right?
Right.
And that's going to come into play in our next story.
Yeah, speaking of coveralls, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Somewhat comical. So
we will get there, but he's expressed his doubts and how he's having second thoughts about joining this team and missing his family, and he's holding his powers back, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Continuing his little subplot of feeling like lesser than on this team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Wolverine thinks about it and puts himself in harm's way while Colossus is trying to stretch out the room as they're testing his strength, testing his powers, and he's saying he can't hold the walls forever. You're going to be crushed, Wolverine. Meanwhile, Wolverine's got his animatum skeleton. He's going to be fine if you think, mm-hmm, about it.
But he's not going to let Colossus know that necessarily, of course.
No.
Now, we do get Storm going on a little side trip to her former, I guess, the apartments that she lived in as
her
child.
Flop house, yes.
Yeah, it's certainly a flop house now where
now
we've got derelicts, just drug addicts, and Misty Knight and Luke Cage happen to pop in here and give Storm a little talking to about life on the main streets. It comes across as a little bit preachy and maybe after school specially, but when you think about Storm as a character,
right,
and where she is at this point, it is a little bit appropriate because she hasn't had this exposure to United States kind of city culture since she has lived so much of her life as a goddess in Africa. So this is something that she is maybe encountering really for the first time. And I mean, it's kind of shocking to see this scene in a, you know, late 1970s mainstream comic. It's sort of heavy, actually.
Yeah.
as dated as it is, frankly, but you know, you're talking about heroin use and just all this pretty just rough material for a mainstream superhero comic.
Yeah, and they call it a shooting gallery, which I had never heard that terminology before. And
I don't know that I've ever heard that either. So no. Must be a sign of the times.
Yeah, you have everybody strung out on the floor, different races, different genders, different. They all seem to be teenagers, though, for the most part, at least the way Byrne draws them.
It's a shooting gallery, and they're all riding the horse.
Yeah, they don't. I don't think they ever say heroin, but they're obviously implying it. Right. You see needles, you see people smoking it, whatever.
And yeah, it's. I mean, I don't mean to laugh at. I mean, certainly this is a very serious thing. It's just, you know, the way it comes across is, like I said, heavy-handed, but still really unexpected for the time period.
Yeah, and one of these characters actually looks a little bit like Callisto, if you think about it. Like
an early
version of Callisto. Yeah.
Not sure I ever took note of that.
Except it's a guy. So
well,
so, yeah. And looking back, that's a dude with just kind of a Callisto.
They did have that one character in the Morlocks who could reshape people's appearances.
Yeah.
What was his name? Mask. Yeah. His name was Mask, and he could reform people's physical appearances. And, like at one point his go-to move seemed to be giving people, tentacle arms, because he did that to Gene, and then but at the time Mask was depicted as female, so right. I don't know that it was a kind of a intended to be a gender transition for this character, or if it's just Claremont being Claremont. But Mask then gave Storm, I think it was Storm, tentacle arms, and there was implied tentacle porn between she and Callisto in a hot tub. This was in the ill-fated Extreme X-Men, I believe.
Oh,
you remember that series?
That's not even continuity, Tim. That's Claremont fanfic.
It does really feel like it.
But interesting thematically that this kind of leads to the Morlocks later in Claremont's run.
It does, yeah, in a kind of indirect way.
Storm feeling compelled to reach out to the lesser thans, to the street kids.
Mm-hmm. Sort of stepping down from her place of privilege in a way. And Colleen Wing gives Scott a key to her apartment.
Yes. Come on over, so, Scott.
Right, and I mean, it's again here. Does she not know that Gene is believed dead? I mean, apparently. It seems like that's something she would have talked about with her best friend, Misty Knight.
Yeah, I think we're figuring out that Misty Knight is a real bitch, is what we're finding. she's manipulative. I don't know. She's.
It could be that Colleen just doesn't care one way or another, which. So be it. That's fine, I suppose. But, I mean, and the first time she meets Scott, she kind of thinks, oh, what a babe. It's too bad he's spoken for, or something like that. So, I mean, she knows Gene is, or thinks that Gene is in the picture, but whether Scott has told her, oh, she's dead, or if she just hasn't come up, it's not really mentioned here. But yeah. So be it. I guess that is going to be sowing the seeds of some romantic tension, perhaps. We'll see.
It definitely looks like where they're going. But meanwhile, Jean's halfway across where she's on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean now.
Mm-hmm.
This is more of a standalone issue if we think about it, because the next two work more as a two-pack. So we have this one issue break, and then we're back to the twos. And the end of, I believe it's the end of 122, we get a private jet with not an H on it, like the X-Men were just on, but one with a bold letter A, much like Archie Andrews would have on his airplane, were he independently wealthy. And we see Kane Marco the Juggernaut with Black Tom Cassidy, who is, what's his relationship with Banshee?
Black Tom and Banshee. Oh God, I think they are cousins, but it could be for some reason I have it in my head that Black Tom is his uncle.
Uncle, I think. Yeah, I know.
So I think depending on the medium, actually, they may be cousins or uncle nephew. But in the comics, gosh, if you put a gun to my head, I would say uncle nephew.
Right. So they're flying.
So viewers may, or listeners may be screaming at their podcasting devices right now, but I'm sorry. I'm not up on my continuity and family relationships of the Cassidys. The Summers I can do front to back all day long, but oof, these folks, it's a little tough.
Let's do a quick family tree for Banshee. We have Black Tom and we have Siren. Yes.
Yes.
And that's it. did he
even... Siren is Banshee's daughter and
with
was
Moira?
Was raised,
no.
No. Just I think unidentified, or she may have been identified, but woman of no real note in any of these stories. But she was raised by Black Tom. I know that largely. Whom she refers to as her uncle.
Okay.
So which here again.
Yeah, that would imply that they're brothers.
Great uncle, but if it's cousins. Her dad's cousin, she might still think of as an uncle. Who cares, right?
Yeah. Juggernaut's a classic villain. I mean, he showed up a lot in the old X-Men, and I think they weren't using him effectively at this point.
Not really. I mean, he and Black Tom had one earlier appearance going against this iteration of the X-Men. It was the same story where the hovercraft gets destroyed.
Yeah.
So while they're in Muir Island, they were attacked by Black Tom and Juggernaut. And I believe that was Black Tom's first appearance. And Juggernaut was just being dusted off, like you said, as an old X-Men villain who still had some viability as a threat to this team. But I would agree that he wasn't really being used to his potential. He was, I'm going to do it again, he was kind of a jobber to the stars, right?
Yes, yeah. And I think down the road, I mean, is he in Secret Wars, or he's in one of the big crossovers, you see him used more in the Marvel universe. I think of the Romita days as being more effective use of Juggernaut, honestly.
Yeah, me too. He has that really good story in Amazing Spider-Man that Roger Stern wrote.
Yeah,
that,
nothing can stop the Juggernaut. Yeah,
that's it. And that's
the other one where he tows Manhattan. Is that's a different one?
I feel like Hercules did that.
Is that Hercules? Okay, maybe
but maybe they both.
I don't remember. Maybe I'm getting my strong guys. That's right. Maybe it's just them thinking he was such an unstoppable force. That's a great.
Was that
Spider-Man
the same story where Galactus takes off his helmet and gets drunk?
I don't know. That would be Associate Editor's Month, I think, or Assistant Editor's Month.
Yeah, Assistant Editor's Month, right?
Yeah. So
yeah, this is a classic Claremont staple, the quiet story, right? The one and done. We're just going to take stock of everybody. There's no real action to speak of.
They didn't play baseball, but it's wintertime. So.
But it's wintertime, yeah. And we're just sort of catching up with various characters where they're at. Character-focused, character-driven story.
Yeah. Fixing the phones, fixing the airplane.
Right. That's the extent of the excitement here.
Getting a key from Colleen Wing, even though your love of your life is secretly still alive. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we end the issue with a reveal that Black Tom, I'm going to keep calling him Black Tom. He should just be Tom Cassidy, right? I mean, Black Tom,
sure.
We're in the late 70s. If you heard a character who had black in his name, it was Black Panther, Black Vulcan, or Black Lightning, Black Goliath. Black Tom, you look at him and what?
He's an Irish dude. No. He's a very Irish white dude. Yeah.
So it just feels weird for me. But in this era, they're revealed to be on Arcade's airplane. And who is Arcade?
Oh, Arcade is far from my favorite character. He is purportedly a master assassin, and he's like a Beverly Hills rich kid who was so bored and with nothing to do, nothing to really spend his money on and make a contribution to the world, that he decides he wants to build elaborate murder devices and pit superheroes against these traps that he's created, which he operates out of a headquarters known as Murder World, where nobody makes it out alive, except everyone always does.
Always.
Since he's a comic book supervillain. He had his first appearance in a Marvel team-up story.
Okay.
That was the series that was basically Spider-Man plus one. So in that story, it was Spider-Man and Captain Britain making his first American appearance, his first appearance in American comics, I should say, because Captain Britain was a Marvel UK character. So there were actually tons of Captain Britain comics in existence, but this is the first time he really is popping up in the mainstream North American market. And he was, this is of course Brian Braddock. He was Peter Parker's short-lived college roommate, which oddly enough doesn't come up very often.
No, you don't hear that referred to, at least in like Excalibur or all these later appearances of Captain Britain.
Not really.
You would and think. It's, yeah. What are the odds, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Superhero and a superhero were roommates.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this was a story written by Chris Claremont, of course. He did a lot of work on Marvel Team Up.
He did.
John Byrne, too.
Had a run, this, yeah.
Mm-hmm. During this time period.
One of my favorite Marvel Team Ups from that era was a Spider-Man and Human Torch versus the Super Skrull.
Oh, that sounds like
and that was Claremont Byrne. Very, very good. But Joe Sinnott on inks, I believe, or somebody like that. So it changed the Byrne art just enough that you wouldn't necessarily recognize it as John Byrne. Kind of like George Perez, too. You look at those old Fantastic Fours, and they're so inked and finished by different guys. It doesn't quite look like the Perez we got in DC era, and then later Avengers, too.
Yeah, yeah. I think of Perez and really the inker on most of his Avengers run from the late 90s. Who was it, Al Fay?
Al Fay, uh-huh.
So I'm not sure if Perez had a regular inker back during this time frame, but you're right that his work does look distinctive, dramatically different. So, and we talked about how Byrne's usual inker was Terry Austin, who is around for pretty much all of this run.
Almost all of this run, yeah.
Yeah, with some exceptions here and there, which do stand out.
Yeah, that first Japan issue was Rick Villamonte on inks, and the faces looked very different, especially smaller faces, like he redrew them or couldn't ink them with the detail that Austin does. Austin was so good for Byrne.
Yeah, no doubt.
And you'll see that Austin would ink Cockrum's covers, too. Cockrum was still doing the X-Men covers at this point.
That's a good point, yeah. Byrne was considered good, but not really good enough to be a cover artist at this point. So
what a bunch of shit that is. It's a bunch of horse shit right there.
Bullshit politics in the back. So Dave Cockrum is still banging out the covers for much of this run, which had to – I mean – I don't care who you are. That's going to be a point of contention.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Just the action layouts and things. Cockrum could do some pretty good poses, but if you go image to image, Byrne is telling a more dynamic and even more Marvel type story, painting more Marvel type pictures. And eventually he'll get his covers, but it's still kind of jarring where you have this, it's an adequate cover. And then the art is just, state of the art for back then. It was the grand best thing going on.
It's often the inverse of that, right?
Yep.
Where you have a really popping cover and then you read the book itself, and it's just blah.
Yeah, it's just functional, but nothing. Yeah, and classic reveal of Arcade being the next villain for the next arc. And this is a good time to take a break. We will pause at the end of 122, and we'll take a commercial break. And when we come back, we will be on Murder World Revisited.
Oh, yes.
Which is what they're calling this title, which will be cool. And we will see you when we get back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And, of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit clotheslines and headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Left Is from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Welcome back to Conversation Comics here, going issue by issue with Tim Capel on the Claremont and Byrne run of Uncanny X-Men from the late 70s. We are picking it back up on issue. I do that every time I say episode, but it's really issues, issue 123. But before we do that, let's, Tim, what are you working on these days? What can people hear you on in case I forget to get your plugs in at the end of the show?
Oh, sure. Well, I'm not sure you can call it work, but I am one of the co-hosts of the monthly podcast series, WCW Survey Says, which is a retrospective kind of 360-degree look at the world of world championship wrestling with my co-host Andy Helene. So, show drops once a month. We just did our most recent episode focusing on the cruiserweight division of WCW, kind of the heyday. of that time period with our good friend Steve Willey. And that episode was released, in mid-December. We'll be coming back in probably early January. I won't reveal yet what the topic of that show is, but we've got another great guest lined up. So it's a bit of a shit show, but it's supposed to be, and it's a lot of fun to do. So that's where you can hear me regularly. And, of course, be sure to check out the Place to Be Nation holiday special, which, as of this recording with Todd, has not yet dropped, but should be available at least soon or maybe recently dropped, depending on when this goes out.
Yes, I have.
Because if nothing else, they need to get it out before the 25th of December. So you can look for that soon on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed. Survey says also found on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, the main feed and the best feed, in my opinion. Although the Place to Be Nation pop feed is a very, very close second.
Wow.
And you can find me on various shows on that as well.
Shots fired.
I didn't mean to do that in all honesty. It just sort of came out. You know what I mean? It just happens sometimes.
The last thing we need is an interpromotional war between the main feed and the pop feed.
Yeah, especially within the same promotion. It just wouldn't work out in anyone's favor.
It's like NXT invading WWE or something.
Right,
like
right. It's like one division of a company suing another. It's just nothing good can come of that. But yeah, I don't have any regular contributions to the Place to Be Nation pop channel, but check that out as well. A lot of good content there. So including this here show.
This here show. We also have Hard Traveling Fanboys, the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in Place to Be Nation pop history.
And, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a good show. They've been on fire lately, looking at all kinds of different things and the Marvel movies in order and Darth Vader, the Kieran Gillen Marvel series. So lots of good things going up.
Mm-hmm. The Long Book Hunters, yep. Part of that show.
We've got Geek and Sassy. We've got Russell Sellers.
Russell Sellers
Points. Yep. So, yep. And Glenn Butler's, I don't know what we call that show. Glenn's.
He didn't either, as of his last. Yes, he forgot the name of his own show as of the last one that they dropped. But the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular.
There it is.
With Glenn Butler and his brother Scott. Yeah. Always good stuff to be found there. So, yep. And Conversation Comics, yeah. Which it is so good to have you back in the game, Todd.
Thank you. Well, you're a big part of it. I had run out of some juice, and a lot of things were going on during the fall, but we're back in the swing of things. And I guess this is a monthly show at this point, so I'm going to try and get one up every month. And I think we're going to stick with this series for a bit just because it's working out really well, and I'm getting geeked on it. It's been a lot of fun to look at these early X-Men issues, at least relatively in the 700 plus episode or issues. I did it again. Issues of Uncanny X-Men at this point, but they've been rebooted time and with number ones over and over. But if you just laid them end to end, there would be a lot of them.
Of course.
But
well, anytime you want to talk about old ass Marvel comics, I would be thrilled to do that with you. I don't care what the series is. It just so happens that this is one that's so near and dear to my heart, yeah. One of my favorites. But I mean, if there's anything, I would definitely be down because I've probably either read it or am familiar enough with it that I could be of some use in discussing it. Might need to revisit, but that's not hard to do with Marvel Unlimited and so many resources that we have nowadays.
Yes. The between the internet and just Wikipedia's where we can look up things that we kind of remembered.
And, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So be looking for a special podcast on Star Comics with me and Tim Capel sometime next year. Looking probably Heathcliff.
I was about to say Heathcliff, right? Real underrated series there.
Yeah.
Maybe some Care Bears and Muppet Babies. And
Peter Porker, perhaps. We'll see. So
Masters of the Universe.
No, were they ever part of Star? Or they were DC? I thought.
Well, DC did some licensed He-Man comics, but I think under the Star brand, I know that there was a Masters of the Universe series that Marvel published. It was terrible. It was far inferior, unfortunately, which is not saying much for this property. Let's have a sense of perspective here. But in comparison to the DC stuff, and even like the little mini comics that, you know, they released with the action figures,
yes,
these were not great achievements in comic book storytelling. But
no. Well, it was it wasn't a great Filmation series, cartoon series.
Oh, my goodness. No.
You know, it does not hold up.
Yeah, that's one you cannot revisit as an adult. Some things you try to reclaim from your childhood, and then you know, like, oh, there's a reason why I can't do this anymore, and I should have disowned this. And that's what happens a lot with these Filmation properties.
Yes.
Please do not go back and try to reclaim your childhood if you were a He-Man / Masters of the Universe fan.
Oh, no. So looking at X-Men 123, we've got the beginning of a two-part Murder World arcade series. And cover of 123 is interesting. You've got the X-Men kind of bouncing around like pinballs, as depicted by Dave Cockrum again. You've got... Mm-hmm. Banshee flying, even though he's powerless, and
right.
Colossus, Wolverine. It's kind of a stiff cover, though, if you think about it. It's just kind of...
That's the word that came to mind as well when I was looking at these covers. It's distinctively Cockrum, but here again, it's not really what's reflected on the interiors.
What's interesting, that cover, 123, doesn't say Cockrum anywhere, but it does say Terry Austin. So I wonder if... He flew solo. It's the first solo cover Austin did, or Cockrum didn't do a treatment for it, or what. But I thought it was Cockrum, too, looking at the figures of the X-Men on there. But it just says Terry Austin, so who knows?
Could be Terry Austin aping Cockrum. Mm-hmm. Who knows? One of the things that really stands out to me and sort of sums up my feelings towards this little 1-2 punch of an arc here is that, for starters, Spider-Man has a guest appearance, right?
Yes.
And as we mentioned, Arcade made his first appearance in a Marvel team-up story not too long before this, which was a Spider-Man story. And he just so happens to meet up with Scott Summers and Colleen Wing on a date, and he just sort of, you know, is saying hi to them. Nice little, you know, bit of character interaction. Can't even call it a crossover proper here, but Marvel was fond of leveraging their advantages of the shared universe to allow these little cameos. But what comes to mind is he recognizes that Arcade is behind their kidnapping by, of all things, the sound effect. So what happens here is like this souped up
slang.
Yep. The souped up garbage truck comes along and like scoops up Cyclops and Colleen here. And it makes a slaflang.
Not
as
just
you said.
Not just a slaflang, a gnr slaflang.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep. It was a hyphenated sound effect.
Yes. And
thereby,
the actual panel. Is that who did the lettering on this? Or Kozowski?
I would guess. Yeah, I'm guessing Wojciechowski. Yeah.
Yeah, there he is. And
we will say his name different every single time we.
We need to talk to Ben Morrison and find out how to actually pronounce noted X-Men letterer Tom O's actual name.
But that's an important one. Yep. And so not only do we get the sound effect, we then get Spider-Man swinging away and repeating it to himself. It's a flang? It's a flang? That must be Arcade.
That's great. Yeah, if you go back and look at the actual panel where the garbage truck sucks up Colleen and Scott, in the background is the Sanctum Sanctorum,
mm-hmm.
which is just a random cameo. You know, it
yep.
shows what block they are. And they're in Greenwich Village, apparently.
Apparently, so, yeah, they must be, since that's Doctor Strange's brownstone.
Yeah, but he doesn't help out. It's all Spider-Man on this one.
Well, sort of. He vows to rescue the X-Men because he has beef with Arcade.
Right.
And I believe he destroys a phone booth in the process. He's so outraged by this turn of events. And then we don't see him again.
Spider-Man's gone. They just used him to sell a couple copies.
Yeah, I guess he searched and searched, but to no avail, because we do not see Spider-Man again. But at least we got a little glimpse of him here, which it's not like he turned up very often in the pages of X-Men.
No.
I guess used to good effect when the opportunity presented itself.
Yeah. You would see X-Men in Marvel team up every so often, not so much in Amazing Spider-Man or Spectacular Spider-Man, but Marvel team-up, you'd have the solo versions of the X-Men sometimes and the team itself.
Right, right. Occasionally they would come in, yeah. And they had that interaction during the first Secret Wars as well.
That's
where
true.
Spider-Man kicks all their asses pretty much.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, Jim Shooter.
I know, right? Yeah.
So the rest of the team, actually not the rest of the team, but we have Kurt and Peter on a double date watching the Bolshoi Ballet at the Lincoln Center.
Yep. They are with their regular kind of main squeezes of Betsy and Amanda, the flight attendants, although then stewardesses.
Right.
Right?
Waitresses in the sky.
Because it is the 70s, who we saw rather early on during this period of X-Men, dating back to the Claremont Cockrum run, I believe. Amanda turns out to be a fairly significant character,
right,
especially to Nightcrawler. Betsy, not so much.
And did they retcon Amanda? Because, like, I remember her being kind of his sister, in fact. Not biologically, but...
Yes.
Okay.
So, well, I guess we can go ahead and spoil it. Amanda here is Amanda Sefton, who is Nightcrawler, Kurt Wagner's adopted sister from his days in the circus. Because comics.
Yes.
And she is a sorceress of all things. So that was a retcon. It was yet to be revealed at this point. I think it comes about in like one of the annuals that's published just a couple years later where like they have to rescue Nightcrawler's soul from limbo or hell or something. It was a really weird story. I think that's where that reveal takes place.
And Betsy, she doesn't turn out to be anybody of note?
No, I gather she's just a coworker of Amanda's. She was just there to – I mean, both of them at this point are just to provide regular dates for Nightcrawler and Colossus.
Okay.
But one of whom just turns out to be more significant. Which it's just a thing that Claremont does.
Yeah,
no,
he would.
You know, again, the hovercraft, the hoverboat operator turning up again and creepily lurking in the pages of the subplots, being such a thing is oh so very Claremont.
I wonder if he had a bulletin board up at the time with all these characters and where they were left off. And
I don't think he did, because from what I understand, his rather frequent editor, Anne Nesenti, and recollections of her time working with Chris Claremont would have to remind him on occasion, you know, Chris, you haven't done a whole lot with such and such a subplot or character that you introduced 30 issues ago. You might want to circle back to that. And he goes, oh, yeah, that's a good point. I've been trying to come up with ideas for my next issue. So, yeah, thank you for the reminder. So he did have some editors who were keeping score of these things, perhaps a little bit better than Claremont the writer was himself. It just seemed like he would glom on to certain ideas and characters more than others. And there were certainly some that he – would either forget about or just lose interest in and would fall by the wayside.
Yeah.
But if there is ever an opportunity to plug in a character he had written before, even in another series, he would go for it.
Yeah. And it just was convenient for him, especially with these Iron Fist characters.
Right. Yeah. And Misty Knight and Colleen Wing from what I understand, the new writer on, I guess it would have been, was Power Man and Iron Fist a joint series at this point?
I believe so.
I think it was. Didn't really have much use for them and was going to write them out of the book. And Claremont was like, well, I almost created them and I have a fondness for the characters. Can I use them? And they're like, sure, no problem. And then when Joe Duffy started writing Power Man and Iron Fist, he wanted them back with good reason. And Claremont really had no problem relinquishing these characters since they were still going to be getting some shine. But it was just sort of like a way of rescuing them from limbo, character limbo and obscurity, to incorporate them in X-Men. And that's sort of the reason why you see them popping up as much as they do, even though they seem a little bit tonally at odds sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I've read these stories so much that I'm just really used to them as X-Men supporting characters, even realizing and acknowledging that really they seem like they belong in the Power Man yes. / Iron Fist family of characters.
Now, Colleen Wing, is she Asian?
I don't know.
I don't know. She's not necessarily drawn as such, especially with the coloring on Marvel Unlimited.
Right, right.
So she's got auburn hair. And
she comes across as pretty, you know, typically Caucasian. Mm-hmm. There may be some elements of just cultural appropriation to her character, which was certainly a thing in the 70s, and certainly a thing with the kind of kung fu fad that by this point was certainly wearing out its welcome. But there were some holdovers from that. So I sort of feel like she's not okay. of Asian descent, but I don't want to say for sure. Perhaps she is.
I'll have to dig a little further. Meanwhile, Kurt and Peter get kidnapped along with their dates by the mysterious, who is it? The Dragon Lady? No, who is it? It's Miss Locke.
Miss Locke, yes. Arcane.
Miss Tessmacher, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his assistant, who seems to hold him in some disdain.
Yes.
I don't know if it's been established at this point, because Arcade has not made many appearances, but they apparently have this thing where once a year, it might even be like on his birthday, she tries to assassinate him. And he's just really into that. And he always manages to thwart her attempts. So it sort of makes you wonder how sincere these attempts are.
Yeah.
But that was some coloring to their relationship, which was added later on. But Arcade, if you're wondering, if you've never encountered this character before, John Byrne has pretty much described him as being all Claremont. Byrne had very little contribution to Arcade's characterization or his design. As he put it, I basically just added the shoes. Claremont conceived him. He picture Malcolm McDowell from A Clockwork Orange, and then put him in the Good Humor Man ice cream suit, right?
Yeah, bright white
and
suit.
You basically got the visual of Arcade. Now, character-wise, he was sort of inspired by H.H. Holmes, who – are you familiar with this?
No. Historical? Who is that?
Okay. H.H. Holmes was a serial killer from around the turn of the 20th century. He had a bit of a flair for the dramatic. He was into luring tourists away from the site of the World's Fair from, I want to say, it was like in the 1890s, okay? So you have all these tourists, and he would lure them to this mansion that he devised for murder purposes, basically. So essentially, It's like Arcade's Murder World, only in real life. I mean, okay. This is some really fucked up, scary shit. I mean, he had houses that they would have hallways that just led nowhere. All kinds of elaborate traps that he would set up and means of disposing of his victims. So if you ever want to go down like a Wikipedia wormhole, look up H.H. Holmes. He's a rather fascinating, if grotesque, character.
Right on.
Wow. It happens to be a real, actual person. So there's precedent to some of this stuff. I mean, not to the camp extremes that we see on display from Arcade in this storyline, but that's what this is borrowing a page from.
Okay. So, good to know. H.H. Holmes is really Arcade, or at least Chris Claremont channeled his fascination with that character into that historical figure into Arcade. We've got Wolverine on a date with Mariko Yoshida, or at least eating dinner with her at the Japanese consulate uptown.
Yeah, by coincidence, she manages to show up in New York as well, right?
Right.
It makes a degree of sense, I suppose, because she is supposed to be this kind of like Japanese dignitary.
Right, and ambassador kind of thing.
Ambassador, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And but it's very formal. they have a nice, polite goodbye. He asks her out again, and then he walks out and is approached for a light by the garbage man, who we've seen before.
Yes.
And promptly gets captured. Any thoughts on Wolverine at this point? Wolverine going a little bit more into Mariko and saying she's different from all the other broads that he used to be with, like Cracklin Rosa from Calgary. And so I don't know. I kind of got he mentioned her during the Calgary arc, and it made it sound like that was part of a whorehouse or something. So
I know it really did. And there's another kind of line. It wasn't so much a line as it was a thought bubble that he had during that storyline. He's thinking about Mariko. He's just so smitten with her, right? And he thinks to himself, love, who needs it? And then next, in the same panel, actually, different thought balloon, me. And it's like, it's so un-Wolverine, but to get that insight into his internal monologue like that, it's something that we've lost in modern comics. And I don't want to sound like the get off my lawn type of guy, but these thought balloons definitely served a purpose.
Absolutely.
And were used when they were used to good effect, could really lend some insights. And Claremont did that especially well. I think that's probably why some of his modern day writing has suffered a bit. It's not so much a case of a clash of styles as the medium itself has changed so much that it doesn't really support the type of writing that he excelled at. But that's a bit of a tangent. And as far as this relates to Wolverine, I just appreciate this for – I don't want to call Mariko a cipher as a character because she is very new and just hasn't had much of an opportunity to be established that much as a fleshed-out character. Mm-hmm. So I want to still give Claremont the benefit of the doubt that will change, right? But for the function that she serves right now, I appreciate that because it distances him from Jean.
Yeah. He literally says, living day by day was fine for broads like Cracklin' Rosa or maybe even Jean Grey, but not Mariko. You know, so she makes him want to be a better man, it seems.
It makes it clear that while he did kind of have it hard for Jean for a while, he's moved on. That's ancient history. As far as he's concerned, she's dead, but even if she wasn't, he has someone else who is catching his eye and who he is going to be pursuing and potentially is going to change him as a person. And that says a lot for a character like this.
He's not exactly lying on his bed holding a picture of Gene at this point.
No, and slicing it with one claw.
No. We get a brief interlude back at the X-Mansion, and there is our friend Sean Cassidy, the powerless Banshee, hanging out, falling asleep by the fireplace. And let's see.
Reading Finnegan's Wake, of all things.
Oh, goodness.
Which is something I don't think I'd wish on my worst enemy.
No. Not reading Ulysses. He's reading not the better known James Joyce book.
Oh, my goodness.
That's funny.
and then, who has failed to get in touch with the love of his life, Moira McTaggart. Again, for weeks on end here, he's still – so I don't mean to keep beating this dead horse,
no.
But the cracks in this whole the X-Men are dead gag are definitely wide. They've been widening, but they have just been blown open.
Just rumors of them being alive and in the mansion have traveled to Muir Island at this point?
Yeah. I mean, they're a team of American superheroes who saved Japan and then had what I imagine would be a pretty high-profile scuffle with the premier Canadian superhero team. So this stuff would make headlines, you would think.
Maybe they're cut off from all newspapers and things like that on the island. I don't know. It's a good question that maybe we can give them a hard time. The next convention I see Claremont at, I'm going to say, you know what? Fuck you, Chris. No, I won't say that. We do see that the X phone is working. The phone in the X mansion is working just fine at this point.
I hope the Cerebro direct line is working.
Well, we'll see. I don't see that extension lit, but Banshee gets captured. And does he get captured by Arcade himself here? Or
I'm not entirely sure on this. It could have been an agent dispatched on Arcade. Maybe it was Miss Locke. Who's to say?
Yeah, well, Miss Locke has a hairy wrist, if that is.
Uh-oh.
Underneath that white glove.
That's my notes.
Yeah, it's a green shirt with a white jacket above it and a white glove. So I assume it's Arcade, but we'll see. It's not like him necessarily to do that. But yes, it is. It is him because the next page he captures Storm, who is taking a shower in the mansion, which is nice. Now, when Storm takes a shower, does she generate the rain clouds and do it herself, or does she use the plumbing?
She does. As I understand, she generates her own showers, which boy, does that sound like a loaded statement.
Hey, now.
Because she resided in the attic of the X-Mansion. She converted that kind of into almost like a greenhouse where she just had an array of plants, which frequently would go neglected during these long jaunts overseas and die. Which they would call attention to from time to time. But no, she was known for taking these showers just by generating the rain clouds internally here in the attic.
Excellent. Okay.
Which,
that's good. Good.
Probably can't be good for the woodwork, but you know, it's an old mansion. These things do need upkeep from time to time. So I'm sure they coped with it in whatever fashion the superheroes cope with these kind of concerns.
She leaves her self-styled shower to answer the phone because Banshee's asleep, and she's complaining, what a time for the phone to be ringing. She goes to answer it, and she gets shot in the back by who we see is actually Arcade, who answers the phone himself, and who's there calling the X-Men, but there's Spider-Man in the phone booth at that point. So
okay, yes.
We do.
Here's a reach. Trashes the phone booth.
Then he gets mad and trashes it because, because Arcade calls him out, basically. And so Peter hulks out and says, no, and destroys a phone booth, which is not necessarily in character for him, I would say, but
I suppose not. That's another just relic of the time, though. Just a phone booth, right? That I wonder if contemporary readers looking over this now, I'm sure they would know what that is, but just, I don't know. It seems somewhat archaic now.
Well, even in Superman, the motion picture in 1978, you know, there's the classic scene of Clark Kent looking to change into Superman, and all he sees are these half-shell phone booths. So, in New York City, in real life, in 1978. So,
yeah. Right.
Because we're approaching, I believe, spring of 1980 in the actual comics timeline that we're reading here. So 2 years removed from that. We get to Murder World, and all the X-Men are waking up. We have the complete team of Cyclops, Colossus, Wolverine, Nightcrawler, Banshee, and Storm all captured and in a giant pinball machine, basically. It looks like it. That's where they are.
Yeah, I think that's the idea. They're in these these little balls that are dispatched to different environments tailored to each X-Man's specialty, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. In the underground complex of Murder World. Is this under New York?
I guess. It's a little bit vague because the thing of it is, Arcade is such a throwback Silver Age type of villain that details like this are easy to gloss over. And this is sort of my problem with Arcade. He can be fun in certain stories, but I think those stories have to be almost deliberately subversive and throwbacky. But when he's just played straight like he is here, it doesn't work very well.
No.
At least for me.
Yeah.
I won't call this like a bad story necessarily, because I don't think any of the stories in the Claremont Burn run are bad, but it's a low point. Yeah. I'll
agree with you on that. The art still is fantastic, but if we just, I think you just kind of have to go, comics.
Right. Just roll with it.
Right. They all end up in their own unique environments, their own puzzles that they have to solve. Cyclops is trapped in a room with three exits, and Lady or the Tiger, one of them is you're going to be safe. The other two are horrible deaths. So he's got to figure it out. But Arcade just is setting it up like a game. He doesn't care. Of course, there's no way out of the room at all. Colossus is in a dark room with a chair. And in the previous panel or previous page, you see Colossus has already been changed into his costume. So did Arcade change him into the costume, or was he wearing it underneath? We don't know.
Yeah, I wonder that as well, because actually all the characters are now in costume here, which they weren't necessarily when they were captured.
No,
which
they were is
an unfortunate element to consider in the storyline, too.
So when they were unconscious, did the Garbage Man change them into... That's weird.
I guess they would have had to, yeah. Also, there's only so much you can do with unstable molecules. I don't think you can spontaneously change civilian clothing into superhero outfits.
Colossus was wearing his, you know, kind of the V-flare shoulder pads. Not even shoulder pads. His classic Bronze Age costume before Romita Jr. changed it in the late 90s. Or not late 90s, late 80s. Sorry, excuse me.
Yes.
And when he's human, when he's not in his living organic steel form, he has blue leggings on. Where do they go?
I always have wondered that.
Yeah.
It seems like when he transforms, if here again, the costume is composed of unstable molecules, maybe they are of such a composition that they just deteriorate or recede or disappear in some form, but they come back.
Mm-hmm.
They come back when he reverts to his human form. So I don't know. I get it that the look is a little bit better than him standing around in underwear,
right? Looking like Robin.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
But that was one of those great unanswered questions. Similar to Wolverine's occasionally appearing and disappearing arm hair, too, which I don't know if you've ever noticed. Like when he's in costume, he sometimes is drawn with hairy arms and sometimes isn't, which was, I don't know if that was Byrne just trying to knock out the issue as quick as possible or a distinctive visual look that they were going for based on, you know, actual model sheets, which existed at the time, or what. But that's certainly a thing, too. Wolverine sometimes has arm hair.
Even up on his, like, biceps, you know, or tricep area. So
he's a hairy dude, supposedly. Yeah.
So Colossus is in this dark chamber where he is being interrogated by a Russian KGB agent and accusing him of being a traitor to the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Which plays into some of the guilt and questioning that's going on for Colossus, just in the character arc that's being explored with him, where he's homesick and just doubting himself and just
missing
all this
his family. Yeah, Soviet loyalist. Wolverine is in a hall of mirrors, and he does have his hairy arms here, which is nice.
Okay.
And so do the weird-looking reflections that are coming from the mirrors. They all have hairy Wolverine arms as well, but they're of different... you've got a tall and thin one. You've got a short and squat one. You've got different versions of Wolverine coming after him, which is cool. This is, you know, the classic one issue setup where everybody's in danger and then they move on. Nightcrawler turns out to be in a giant dome area being chased by Razor bumper cars, it looks like. Flying Razor bumper cars that almost look like they have Razor mouths and Razor blades, like battle bots or something.
Uh-huh.
And let's see. He can't see outside, so he doesn't dare teleport outside of his little area, but somehow they catch him anyway. And then our friend Banshee is in just a looks like a World War II battleground being assaulted by looks like Nazi planes. We see one with an actual swastika on it. So, which is an interesting.
And here again, he is depowered. He can't really defend himself in the manner that he would be accustomed to here. But he is nonetheless in costume and very much an active participant in these proceedings.
Yeah, he doesn't have his pipe with him.
No, sadly, he does not. Yeah.
And Arcade has Storm in a trapdoor ocean, kind of a flooded area, and she's looking for a way out. But let's see.
She's kind of underwater trying to use her powers and struggling with that quite a bit.
Yeah, she tries to use her lightning powers to get out and ends up giving her a neural shock and incapacitating her. Cyclops, Wolverine, everybody's trying to get out of there, but they end up, Wolverine and Cyclops are reunited. Cyclops blasts through his door with his optic blast and takes out one of the constructs that's attacking Wolverine, so they team up. But on the last page reveal, Wolverine gets knocked out by an organic metal fist, who we find out belongs to Colossus, of course, who is wearing the fantastic, better than his, well, I don't know. How would you describe it? I'm going to let you talk about this outfit because it is an all-time classic.
I guess that this is supposed to be evoking a Soviet working class kind of individual.
Duh.
Where he's got overalls and like a little beret, but it's gussied up enough that you know he's a citizen of the Soviet Union because
yes.
He's got like the hammer and sickle and a little picture of Lenin.
Lenin. He's got an image of Lenin.
Right on his chest, right?
And then CCCP like we would have on the Canadian hockey jerseys.
Yes. So, and now he is calling himself the proletariat, right? Or the proletarian.
Proletarian, yes. Workers' hero of the Soviet Union.
Exactly.
In so Soviet Russia, proletarian.
This, very brief indoctrination was I guess enough to really break him. He is now, but again, we're talking a real Claremont hallmark here of characters being brainwashed and or mind controlled. And I want to say this is probably the first example of that, isn't it? He hasn't explored that theme up to this point.
Where one turns against them or one is programmed. Yeah, not so much.
But yeah, I mean, mind control is a thing that Claremont is super into and will get more into over time. This is the first time we see it. So yes, Colossus is now refashioned as the proletarian. And wow, yeah. Just... I mean, it's made to seem like a bigger deal than it really is because it's just such a footnote. I mean, it's just a way to, I think, draw a line under all the stuff going on with Colossus where he's feeling ineffective as a team member and he's feeling homesick and missing his family and this type of stuff. It kind of ends with this character turn.
Yeah.
Where he overcomes his programming through the power of love, basically.
And I'm still getting over just the reveal of that costume. Plus Arcade thinking it's just hilarious that Colossus is going to destroy Wolverine and Cyclops. And then we finally get to see Arcade's shoes, right? They're straight up out of Elton John's wardrobe.
Yes.
You know, John Byrne added Elton John's shoes. They are platform shoes with a separated heel, but they've got Converse All-Stars on them and stars on the soles. They're pretty awesome.
Right. So if that was the extent of his contribution to Arcade's character design, then he really made the most of it.
he did. And Arcade's got the civilian dates of Kurt and Scott and Peter wrapped up in nice little packages.
Right. They're all being held hostage, essentially.
Colleen and Amanda and Betsy. So we get a recap in 124, and we get a little Arcade origin story, which is nice. Mm-hmm. And like we're talking about it. And, you know, Arcade was seen in some of the video games, some of the X-Men.
Oh, my God. That was the shittiest fucking video game. Ugh. It was literally called Spider-Man and the X-Men and Arcade's Revenge. That was the name of the video game. It was for both SNES and Genesis.
That's right.
It was unfairly hard. It was just ridiculous where the extent to which you just had to rely on blind luck to advance through the levels of this game was absurd. And the characters were Spider-Man, of course. You had Cyclops, Wolverine in his brown costume, Storm, and Gambit from the X-Men. And, I mean, the gameplay itself wasn't too bad. It just sucked because it was so ridiculously hard. Yeah, I mean, it was stupidly hard. Not just like... okay, I need to really practice and get better at this. There was no getting better at that game.
Just luck.
It was bullshit. Yeah, I hated that game so much. Might contribute to my hatred of Arcade as a character now that I think about.
Yeah, and I associate him with the games too, less the comics, even though he's been in lots of X comics and other ones throughout the years. And they've changed his character quite a bit over the – I remember the Ultimate version was very different too.
Uh-huh, yeah. Oh, God, I'm just thinking about that stupid fucking Storm underwater level, which must have been borrowed from this storyline. Because you can, you'd have to blow stuff up and absorb, air bubbles for health or something in order to progress through her stage. It was ungodly terrible.
So... the X-Men are being beat up by proletarian and going from looks like video game to video game in Murder World.
Basically, yeah. There is a cool scene, which I only, you know, call attention to because of the Cyclops mark in me, where they establish that he has a natural talent for spatial geometry. And this enables him to take out like the half dozen bumper cars with razor blades on them that you mentioned, which were assailing Nightcrawler.
Right.
So with a single blast, he just reflects off of all these different various moving objects and blows them all up.
So is he
that's a really cool looking panel.
Yeah. Zarp, Zram, Zoop, all these Z sound effects by Urquhart.
Yeah.
Is Cyclops therefore the best pool player, billiards player in the Marvel Universe?
He is. There's actually a scene during the Paul Smith run where he like sinks like all the pool balls on a table in a single shot.
That's cool.
Yep.
Wolverine and Banshee are trapped in a game called Battle Star Wars 1999. They're being assaulted by X-Wing fighters and then not Cylons, but the Centurion, I think they're called Centurion ships from Battlestar Galactica, which is pretty funny. Wolverine finds a side panel and they escape. Storm's still underwater. She's come to, but she has to take off her boots so that she can swim effectively, which is kind of cool to see her doing that. We have Wolverine and Banshee open up the side panel and they escape into looks like a Murder World game where there's Magneto and Hulk. It's kind of a random cameo.
Yeah.
And Wolverine has the history with Hulk, but Magneto's just the ultimate ex-baddie. But this is just these are just obviously robots, right?
Yeah, I would gather so.
And
they certainly aren't the genuine article, and I don't think they're like hard light holograms or anything because that technology did not exist, I think, even in anyone's mind at this point.
Mm-hmm. So basically the X-Men, having escaped from Colossus, they're kind of fighting their way towards the control room of Murder World. And they eventually catch up with Miss Locke and Arcade, Nightcrawler captures Miss Locke's pistol and shoots up the control room, and then they rescue the girls, essentially. Storm's level floods over. We find her. She's unconscious, though. Cyclops has to resuscitate her with mouth-to-mouth, and she's alive. But then our friend, the proletarian, has caught up with them.
Yes.
And this time they will not escape. So it looks like Banshee thinks he can take care of things, but he gets hammered by Proletarian. Everybody is being attacked and dominated by him and how it's treason. And it's great monologue by great, quote unquote, great monologue. But Aurora talks some sense into her with, like you said, where, you know, your love. And
again, reminds him. Yes.
You're my little brother, or you're the brother I never had. And then that flicks the switch in him. So he's fine now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all it took. A little cheesy, but effective.
Yeah, but it happened very quickly. I mean, it was just like in three panels.
Yeah, about as quick as his character turn towards the proletariat.
And Arcade has an escape planned. He puts them all in a giant pinball and shoots them out. And so they escape through the Coney Island, looks like. No, it's an abandoned Bronx amusement park. They escape through the Tunnel of Love, and which has a direct line to Murder World, apparently.
I guess so.
Yeah. Arcade releases all the hostages, wrapped up like Christmas packages, and he says, okay, round one to you, next one, and X-Men, until next time. The end, not the end, but he's covering his tracks. The note disintegrates, and they just all
in true supervillain fashion, the note self-destructs, basically. And in all honesty, the X-Men let him off kind of easy.
Yeah.
There's some effort made to call attention to this fact where Wolverine wants to pursue it, and Cyclops is kind of like, hey, it could be anywhere, fuck it. I mean, that's sort of, you know, you would expect a polished team of superheroes, which this team is at this point, to really want to tie off this loose end, but mm-hmm. but they don't. So, and we're all the better for it, because I'm about done with Arcade.
Yeah.
After these two issues.
Yeah, it does stand out as, I mean, you see them using their powers and declaring their love for one another, but it's not one of the all time stories. It really isn't.
Yeah, it's certainly fun. It's inventive. I think you can revisit it kind of in isolation and probably get more from it. But when you're trying to reread this run and you're like, oh yeah, classic Claremont Byrne, you kind of hit this stretch and you're like, ah, shit. Do I really need to? But I mean, that's again, not saying it's bad. It just, it takes a little bit of a dip here.
Yeah. And that pulls us to the end of 124, and we move on to 125, which has, Return of Phoenix on the cover, another mm-hmm. Cockrum Austin cover. Phoenix is the centerpiece, and then she kind of separates. There's what's going on in the Danger Room back in New York. And then you have Muir Island with Havoc and Jamie Madrox and Lorna Dane, who is in just civilian clothes, because her costume was pretty ridiculous at this point.
Yeah, it was just kind of this green and purple number.
I think it was Neil Adams who designed it. It could have been Cockrum, actually, though, because it did look like something out of the Legion of Superheroes, where she had this little barrette thing that stood alone, but you don't see that costume used too often. And in Lorna's case, I mean, I always liked that character, but I always associate her with the just wearing the regular X-Men costume.
Right.
Black and yellow.
Yeah, no frills, really. Mm-mm. And I also associate that character with a lot of mind control here again.
Yeah, she was an easy character just to get controlled by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't enough going on there. 125 starts with Moira checking on Jean's powers. So they're testing her power levels, and so we get to see the Phoenix kind of flare up. But
right. And this is where Moira realizes just how powerful Jean could become, mm-hmm. which is to say godlike. And that dovetails kind of nicely into – there's a lot going on this issue.
Yes.
We revisit Professor Xavier and Lilandra, who is now properly cemented as the Empress of the Shi'ar Empire. Remember, there was some bureaucratic red tape in that transition from her batshit crazy brother to her assuming the mantle of Empress here. So I guess they've gotten that ironed out. She is now recognized as the leader of the Shi'ar Empire, and Xavier is now realizing the full sort of depth and breadth of what Phoenix accomplished mm-hmm. in saving the universe way back in the Cockrum run, which was where we're going back to really Byrne's first issue, is where she repaired the M-Kron crystal. And he, I guess, had not really realized what a feat that took and what this actually meant for Jean in terms of how powerful she was and potentially could still be.
Yeah. And, this issue is mostly about Jean, or at least half of it is, kind of a Jean recap. You get her story of turning into the Phoenix and what's going on and how she feels so alone. And there's mm-hmm. been this, she was talking to her priest who made her feel better, and she started forgetting about things as far as her life back home. So maybe I'm trying to do the retcon myself here. Maybe she was forgetting about Scott because Mastermind, who we find out here, has been manipulating her, has been tweaking things. So, and that's when it starts all one of the all-time favorite arcs, but we'll get to more about him.
This is where she experiences like her first time slip, right? Where
yes.
she all of a sudden finds herself or believes herself to be this sort of, I guess, 18th century noble woman.
Let's see. She does have a little mind, you know, you see her like making faces in the mirror and pretending to be something but Lorna says, come back. And so we don't necessarily see that, her going off into that, the mind slip, which we will see soon enough, but that's,
so we're getting there.
We're just the beginnings of that. Meanwhile,
yes, this was part of the rather subtle, subtle manipulations of one Jason Wingard, otherwise known as Mastermind.
Yeah, this is a slow burn, which is great.
It's a slow burn, yeah. Like, she runs into him at one point, and his Jason Wingard guys, who we don't recognize as readers, but he casts a very familiar-looking shadow.
That's a pretty nice touch by Byrne, because, you know, little do we know that we have seen him before back in the old, olden days. I don't think did Brotherhood of Evil Mutants fight them at this point, this current team?
No, not this team of X-Men. I mean, certainly Jean would be familiar with them, but she has no idea that this is Mastermind scheming and plotting, and neither do we at this point as readers.
Yeah, we have no idea.
Other than that,
the first time.
That little hint. Yeah, that little hint in the shadow.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep.
We also have the situation on Muir Island where Mutant X, who we don't know anything about other than he has controlled the the hovercraft renter.
Yes, Angus McWhorter.
Who's running amok. And so Jean does investigate that, and it's there where she does have her first time slip.
Okay, yeah. And and the thing about this is it isn't just the overt hallucinations that she's experiencing. It's that he's been Mastermind has been worming his way into her psyche, and just all these little interactions that she believes are with different people, but is actually him. He's like kind of creepily stalking her, really,
yes.
and has been doing so since she left the X Mansion. That's how long we learn this has been going on.
Yeah.
So really, like, any scene that we've had, any subplot that's taken place with Jean since that issue where she leaves the mansion, and she, you know, is vacationing in the Greek Isles at one point, then goes to Scotland. You can assume that Jason Wingard is in the background.
Right. And that's just what I was going to say. Any non-player character that she's talked to, we can assume that it's him trying to get into her head.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, pretty cool.
Successful in doing.
We also have a brief Magneto interlude here in this issue where he's just licking his wounds up on the asteroid.
This is good stuff because for really the first time, we're getting some characterization for Magneto that's beyond cackling villain.
Right.
The stuff about him being a Holocaust survivor is still a ways down the road, but here we're actually seeing Magneto more as a character than just an antagonistic plot device. And of note, he is looking and reflecting on a woman that he was married to. We never knew Magneto had been married in a former life, but sure enough, it's confirmed here. He's thinking about his late wife, Magda.
Magda,
yes. And this is significant because the same month that this issue was released – in the Avengers series, which John Byrne also illustrated.
Yep.
Yeah. It was there confirmed that the mother of Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch was a woman named Magda. So, I mean, indirectly here, this is essentially confirming Magneto is the father of Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch.
Was that a Byrne and Stern story?
It was, I was going to say it was a Byrne and Stern creation.
C'thon, or the demon, takes control of Scarlet Witch and hangs them all upside down.
In that famous cover, as I understand it, Byrne and Stern did not really want this to go beyond what they had alluded to. They didn't want to make a big thing of, oh, Magneto is their father, and he was married to this woman, Magda, and they had kids, and all this shit happened. Like, they wanted this to be very much implied and understood, but didn't want to make, like, an actual story of it. And obviously that would not go their way at all. Because them being Magneto's children basically becomes their character over the next, like, two decades.
Yeah, for a long time. That was and they still, you know, they've retconned it again. That's not the case, which is a pain. It doesn't work for me. I think it,
me neither. I have chosen to selectively ignore that.
Okay.
Which is, you know, that's a luxury that I can kind of enjoy as an adult comics reader. I'm like, you know what? If something doesn't work for me, I'm just going to, I'll just disavow it.
It
was true once. It doesn't have to matter. I know that that's what the canon says, but I don't have to care. I really don't. So that's fine. I'm not going to get worked up over it. I'll just choose to not incorporate it into my understanding of these characters. But in any case, that they wanted that to be really the final word on this. And it was subtle. It basically, if you were not reading both Avengers and X-Men, you would not have gotten that out of this at all.
And where would you have discussed it?
Like,
there's no internet to say, hey, cross-reference it. Nobody at the comic shop will say, hey, did you read this? Well, maybe they would. Maybe that would be where it would start, is if somebody
that might be your reference point. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, I think that's what they wanted, for this to be talked about and acknowledged in fan circles, but not beyond that. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, at best, you could say that Magda, as we see her visually here, bears a resemblance to Scarlet Witch, but she also bears a resemblance to Kitty Pryde, who is yet to actually appear.
That's our John Byrne has only a couple female faces that he draws. You know, they all look like Jane Curtin from Kate and Ellie. If you notice that, I used to think that, which is pretty obscure reference. This issue is so much better than the arcade arc. There's so much more going on. It's so much denser. The storytelling's better. It's like so night and day if you think about it.
It's like now all of a sudden, all right, enough with that bullshit. Now we're getting down to business.
Yeah, we're the bigger seeds of a much longer, much more drawn out, much more substantial storyline are being sown. And back at the X-Mansion, Beast shows up. What's he doing? He's investigating that the alarm went off.
Mm-hmm. He's just popping in, which you'd think he would have done at some point in the intervening weeks now at this point.
Well, he's an Avenger, right?
He is. He is an active Avenger, so we can forgive him that. Although, I do notice that Nightcrawler legitimately thinks he's a ghost when he sees him and is freaked out by his appearance.
He is a superstitious one, that Nightcrawler.
Yeah, and it is still the Bronze Age, technically.
Yeah. So we have the Quinjet parked outside. We have Hank McCoy and Nightcrawler getting into it, and then Cyclops showing up and meeting with Hank McCoy, who holds him, and they find out that Jean's alive. Finally.
Right. Finally, we can lay this thing to rest.
Boy, is she ever going to be surprised, says Hank.
Yeah.
So they are all comparing notes and getting caught up, and This is pretty funny because Hank asks Cyclops if he's all right, and the thought bubble says, "I don't know anymore." And then he says, "Yeah, yeah, Hank, I'm fine," which is great. That's just really nicely put.
Again, another great use of thought bubbles where you could totally reveal what's going on, the inner turmoil that's going on with a character that just is beneath the surface of what they're actually saying.
Yeah.
And how is he going to – what, is he going to tell Hank here? Is he going to tell Gene that he's been getting some strange on the side, essentially?
He's got to – oh, Scott, what's this key?
Right.
Whose key is this, Scott?
By the way, what's this note that says drop by any time?
Oh, and it's only – what? I only died in your mind about 6 weeks ago. I don't know.
Yes.
The timetable. Scott gets on the X phone to call Muir Island and say, "Hey, we're coming to get Jean and see you." Well, mm-hmm. I guess because Beast told her that's where she is, or told the X team that that's where Jean is. And meanwhile, they're being assaulted by
Beast, who, by the way, like you said, is an Avenger,
right?
Has done a better job of keeping up with everyone's comings and goings than the team that's been actively trying to contact these people.
I guess they're lost without Professor X.
And they're just inept when it comes to telecommunications.
There's a lot of phone reference, not references, but uses of a telephone on this. And
And by the way, we'll see this in full effect during the whole Cyclops Madeline split thing, uh-huh. where he basically walks out on his wife and kid. Not a high mark for the character, but
no, we've had this conversation.
We have, and it's kind of funny. But, I mean, not funny, but it is. And how he makes attempts to get in touch with Madeline, and like the phone is disconnected, and he's like, "Well, been there, done that. I guess that's the end of our story."
Yeah, that's it.
It's pretty much throws in the
didn't get her on the phone. That's it. Game over.
So that's be it.
He knows the most powerful telepath on Earth.
Right. Say,
could you just call her on the mind phone, please? You know,
if I can't raise somebody on the phone, then that's it. I guess they're just dead to the world.
So Scott's calling Muir Isle, but meanwhile, Mutant X has knocked everything out over there, and it's a shit show. And all that's left right now are Havoc, Multiple Man, and Lorna Dane in her cable knit sweater, who notices that the phone is ringing and answers it because it could be Professor X or the Beast who could help. And then we find out that she finds out that Scott's alive and the rest of the X team are alive. Meanwhile, Wolverine's having a beer in the background quietly. It's just kind of everybody's panicked. Wolverine is drinking a beer. And then while Lorna's telling Scott what's going on, Mutant X appears outside the window and says, "Human, I need you." You hear her over the phone. Scott says, "We've got to go because it's Lorna. I heard her scream," and then the line went dead. So the X-Men are heading over to Muir Island.
Right. And they do not have Beast in tow at this point. Beast has gone back to Avengers Mansion, presumably.
Did they explain?
I think they said that
he said he was going to, but he didn't come. He said, "I wouldn't miss this reunion for the world," but apparently he missed it. Oh, no. He had to take the Quinjet back. That's it.
Yeah, so he's returning the Quinjet.
He was going to come before this became an urgent trip. He was going to go on it, but now that they've got to leave. But this is, even though this is a cliffhanger and it's leading to more of the Mutant X / how do we say it? Proteus?
The saga. Proteus saga.
We are going to have to wrap this up today and leave off at the end of issue 125. So we got through 7 issues this episode of Conversation Comics, which is pretty good. It's not bad. It's about 2 episodes an hour, if you think about it, 2.5 episodes an hour. But it's been a lot of fun looking back at these, and it's interesting the variation in quality. I used to assume they were all terrific, but that arcade storyline, looking at it closer, it's just not very good at all. It's goofy. It's like something out of a lesser comic.
Yeah, it's a little rough. because I think we remember the early bits of their run, like that great Magneto, I think is a great Magneto story, going on into that world tour arc, which even the two issues in Japan, which you can think of as being a little bit disposable because, come on, Moses Magnum as a villain.
And the Mandroids,
yeah. It does have stuff like the first appearance of Mariko and Wolverine being able to speak Japanese.
Character stuff.
More about him. Yeah, a lot of good character stuff in these stories. And what I was going to mention about Moses Magnum that completely slipped my mind is that it was retconned later that Apocalypse, of all characters, was responsible for granting him his earthquake powers.
Okay. So he didn't fall into a pocket of Terrigen mists, is what you're saying.
No, he did not fall into a pocket of Terrigen. He did fall into an earthquake, I think. But was found by Apocalypse. This comes from one of the classic X-Men backup stories that we discussed in our first part.
Yeah. John Bolton art or?
I don't know that Bolton did this one, but I won't say he didn't. I don't know for certain.
Check it out.
But at the time that that storyline was republished in Classic X-Men, Apocalypse had just recently debuted. So because he was going to be such a major character in Louis Simonson's X-Factor, Claremont was kind of throwing her a bone by working him into some, you know, more core X-Men type material. Even though this is largely a footnote in X-Men history, he did put that in there. So there you go.
So was Crackle and Rosie ever one of the four horsemen?
Maybe Pestilence. I'm not sure.
Yeah, there you go. That's it. And which is Wolverine's healing factor. It was never an issue. So
right. Would take care of any venereal disease that he might, which they would have been called back then.
Right, so on.
That's a terrible joke.
Yeah. This is what the first rate content people come to Conversation Comics for. So
at least we're self-aware.
unique perspective that only Tim and Todd can give you on the early X-Men comics of John Byrne and Chris Claremont. So we thank you for checking out this episode of Conversation Comics. We will see you in the new year with a continuation of the Mutant X/Proteus saga. And it's been a pleasure. Happy New Year to you. Tim, anything you'd like to say before we let him go?
Nope. Just thanks for having me back. I'm actually really glad we can make this at least probably three parts.
We've got some pretty major storylines on the horizon, so it might be four to five parts. We'll have to see. Which I'd be okay with.
We're just getting into like the meat of it here, where it goes Proteus, Dark Phoenix, Days of Future Past. Like, to think that we've done two episodes and haven't and are just now approaching that is hard to believe.
Yeah.
So, wow. Good stuff though. Thank you for having me on. I was really looking forward to recording with you. As a matter of fact, it's been kind of a long, rough week for me. So this has been a nice relief. So
it's
been a lot of fun.
And it's been a highlight of my week too. I'm looking forward to getting back with you maybe in January. No, definitely in January and revisiting this. And we will see. We'll pick up with Muir Island is under assault by a mutant who we don't know who he is, even though we've said his name is Proteus. Mutant X, the mysterious Mutant X. So for Tim Capel, this is Todd Weber, and we'll see you on the next episode of Conversation Comics. Happy.
Canada.